Zero, loser, she said. Showing off the number of friends you have? Luce asked. She remembered what Roland had said about showing no fear. She slid the mask down over her face, took her foil from Francesca. Luce didn't even know how to hold it. She fumbled with the handle, wondering whether to put it in her right or left hand. She wrote right-handed, bold and batted with her left. Lilith was already looking at her like she wished Luce were dead, and Luce knew she couldn't afford the time to test out her swing in both hands. Did they even call it a swing in fencing? Wordlessly, Francesca moved behind her. She stood with her shoulders brushing Luce's back, practically folding her narrow body around Luce and taking Luce's left hand and the sword in hers. I'm left-handed, too, she said. Luce opened her mouth, unsure whether or not to protest. Just like you. Francesca leaned around her and gave Luce a knowing look. As she repositioned her grip, something warm and tremendously soothing flowed through Francesca's fingers into Luce. Strength, or maybe courage. Luce didn't understand how it worked, but she was grateful. You'll want a light grip, Francesca said, directing Luce's fingers around the hilt under the guard. Grip too tightly, and your direction of the blade becomes less nimble, your defensive moves more limited. Grip too lightly, and the blade can be spun out of your hands. Her smooth, thin fingers guided Luce's to hold the curved grip of the sword's hilt just under the guard. With one hand on the sword and the other on Luce's shoulder, Francesca galloped lightly sideways one step, blocking out the move. Advance. She moved forward, thrusting the sword in Lilith's direction. The red-headed girl ran her tongue across her teeth and glared at Luce with something like middle child syndrome. Disengage. Francesca moved Luce back as if she were a chess piece. She stepped away and circled to face Luce, whispering, The rest is just gilding the lily. Luce swallowed. Gilding the what?
En garde, Lilith practically shouted.
Her long legs were bent, and her right arm was holding the foil straight at Luce. Luce retreated, two quick galloping steps. Then, when she felt at a safe enough distance, lunged forward with her sword extended. Lilith dipped deftly to the left of Luce's sword, spun around, then came back from below with her own, clashing against Luce's. The two blades slid against each other until they reached a midpoint, then held. Luce had to put all her strength into stopping Lilith's foil with the pressure of her own. Her arms were shaking, but she was surprised to find she could hold Lilith back in this position. At last, Lilith broke away and backed off. Luce watched her dip and spin a few times and began to figure her out. Lilith was a grunter, making tons of effort-filled noise. It was a bit of misdirection. She would make a huge noise and feint in one direction, then whip the point of her foil around in a high, tight arc to try to get past Luce's defenses. So Luce tried the same move. When she swung the tip of her sword back around to get her first point, just south of Lilith's heart, the girl let out a deafening roar. Luce winced and backed away. She didn't think she'd even touched Lilith very hard. Are you okay? She called out, about to lift her mask. She's not hurt, Francesca answered for Lilith. A smile parted her lips. She's angry that you're beating her. Luce didn't have time to wonder what it meant that Francesca seemed suddenly to be enjoying herself, because Lilith was barreling toward her once again, sword poised. Luce raised her sword to meet Lilith's, turning her wrist to clash three times before they disengaged. Luce's pulse was racing, and she felt good. She sensed an energy coursing through her that she hadn't felt in a long time. She was actually good at this, almost as good as Lilith, who looked like she'd been bred to skewer people with sharp things. Luce, who had never even picked up a sword, realized she actually had a chance to win. Just one more point. She could hear the other students cheering, some even calling out her name. She could hear Miles, and she thought she could hear Shelby, which really egged her on. But the sound of their voices was woven through with something else, something staticky and too loud. Lilith fought as fiercely as ever, but suddenly Luce was having a hard time concentrating. She backed up and blinked, looking into the sky. The sun was obscured by the overhanging trees, but that wasn't all. A growing fleet of shadows was stretching forth from the branches, like ink stains, extending right above Luce's head. No, not now, not in public with everyone watching, and not when it might cost her this match. Yet no one else even noticed them, which seemed impossible. They were making so much noise it was impossible for Luce to do anything but cover her ears and try to block them out. She raised her hands to her ears, which made her sword tip skyward, confusing Lilith.
"Don't let her freak you out, Luce. She's toxic," Dawn chirped from the bench.
"Use the prise de fer," Shelby called. "Lilith sucks at the prise de fer. Correction, Lilith sucks at everything, but especially the prise de fer."
So many voices, more, it seemed, than there were people on the deck. Luce winced, trying to block it all out. But one voice separated from the crowd, as though it were whispering into her ear from just behind her head. Stephen.
"Screen out the noise, Luce. Find the message."
She whipped her head around, but he was on the other side of the deck, looking toward the trees. Was he talking about the other Nephilim? All the noise and chatter they were making? She glanced at their faces, but they weren't even talking. So who was? For the briefest moment, she caught Stephen's eyes, and he lifted his chin toward the sky, as if he were gesturing at the shadows. In the trees above her head, the announcers were speaking. And she could hear them. Had they been speaking all along? Latin, Russian, Japanese, English with a southern accent, broken French, whispers, singing, bad directions, lines of rhyming verse, and one long, blood-curdling scream for help. She shook her head, still holding Lilith's sword at bay, and the voices overhead stayed with her. She looked at Stephen, then Francesca. They showed no signs, but she knew they heard it, and she knew they knew she was listening, too, for the message behind the noise. All her life she'd heard the same noise when the shadows came, whooshing, ugly, wet noise. But now it was different. Clash. Lilith's sword collided with Luce's. The girl was snorting like an angry bull. Luce could hear her own breath inside the mask, panting as she tried to hold Lilith's sword. Then she could hear so much more among all the voices. Suddenly she could focus on them. Finding the balance just meant separating the static from the significant stuff. But how?
"Il faut faire le coupe double. Après ça, c'est facile à gagner,"
one of the announcers whispered in French. Luce had just 2 years of high school French to go on, but the words touched her somewhere deeper than her brain. It wasn't just her head understanding the message. Somehow her body knew it, too. It seeped into her, right down to the bone, and she remembered. She'd been in a place like this before, in a sword fight like this, a standoff like this. The announcer was recommending the double cross, a complicated fencing move in which two separate attacks came one right after the other. Her sword slid down her opponent's, and the two of them broke away. A moment sooner than Lilith, Luce lunged forward in one clean, intuitive motion, thrusting her sword point right, then left, then flush against the side of Lilith's ribcage. The Nephilim cheered, but Luce didn't stop. She disengaged, then came straight back a second time, plunging the tip of her foil into the padding near Lilith's gut. That was three. Lilith dashed her sword to the deck, tore off her mask, and gave Luce a terrifying scowl before making quickly for the locker room. The rest of the class was on their feet, and Luce could feel her classmates surrounding her. Dawn and Jasmine hugged her from both sides, giving dainty little squeezes. Shelby came forward next for a high five, and Luce could see Miles waiting patiently behind her. When it was his turn, he surprised her, swooping her off the deck and into a long, tight hug. She hugged him back, remembering how awkward she'd felt earlier when she'd gone to him after his match, only to find that Dawn had gotten to him first. Now she was just glad to have him, glad of his easy and honest support.
"I want fencing lessons from you," he said, laughing.
In his arms, Luce looked up at the sky, at the shadows lengthening from the long branches. Their voices were softer now, less distinct, but still clearer than they'd ever been before, like a static-filled radio she'd been listening to for years that had finally been tuned in. She couldn't tell whether she was supposed to be grateful or afraid. 11. 8 days.
"Hold on," Callie's voice boomed across the line. "Let me pinch myself to make sure I'm not..."
"You're not dreaming," Luce said into her borrowed cell phone. Reception was spotty from her position at the edge of the woods,
but Callie's sarcasm came through loud and clear. It's really me. I'm sorry I've been such a crap friend. It was Thursday after dinner, and Luce was leaning up against the stout trunk of a redwood tree behind her dorm. To her left was a rolling hill and then the cliff, and beyond that, the ocean. There was still a little amber light in the sky over the water. Her new friends would all be in the lodge making s'mores, telling demon stories around the hearth. It was a Dawn and Jasmine social event, part of the Nephilim nights Luce was supposed to have helped organize, but all she'd really done was request a few bags of marshmallows and some dark chocolate from the mess hall. And then she'd escaped, out to the shadowy fringe of the woods, to avoid everyone at Shoreline and reconnect with a few other important things. Her parents, Callie, and the announcers. She'd waited until tonight to call home. Thursday's Shay Price meant her mom would be out playing mahjong at the neighbor's, and her dad would have gone to the local movie theater to watch the Atlanta Opera on simulcast. She could handle their voices on the 10-plus-year-old answering machine message, could manage to leave a 30-second voicemail saying she was petitioning hard for Mr. Cole to let her off campus for Thanksgiving, and that she loved them very much. Callie wasn't going to let her off so easy. "I thought you could only call on Wednesdays," Callie was saying now. Luce had forgotten the strict telephone policy at Sword and Cross. "At first, I stopped making plans on Wednesdays, waiting for your call," Callie went on. "But after a while, I kind of gave up. How did you get a cell phone, anyway?" "That's it?" Luce asked. "How did I get a cell phone? You're not mad at me?" Callie let out a long sigh. "You know, I thought about being mad. I even practiced this whole fight in my mind. But then we both lose." She paused. "And the thing is, I just miss you, Luce. So I figured, why waste time?" "Thank you," Luce whispered, close to tears. Happy ones. "So, what's been going on with you?" "I'm in charge of this conversation. That's your punishment for dropping off my radar. And what I want to know is, what's going on with that guy? I think his name started with a C." "Cam," Luce groaned. Cam was the last guy she told Callie about? "He didn't turn out to be the kind of guy I thought he was." She paused for a moment. "I'm seeing someone else now, and things are really..." She thought of Daniel's glowing face, the way it had darkened so quickly during their last meeting outside her window. Then she thought of Miles. Warm, dependable, charmingly no-drama Miles, who'd invited her home to his family's house for Thanksgiving, who ordered pickles on his hamburgers at the mess hall now, even though he didn't like them, just so he could pick them off and give them to Luce, who tilted his head up when he laughed so that she could see the sparkle in his Dodgers cap-shaded eyes. "Things are good," she finally said. "We've been hanging out a lot." "Ooh, bouncing around from one reform schoolboy to the next. Living the dream, aren't you? But this one sounds serious. I can hear it in your voice. Are you going to do Thanksgiving together? Bring him home to face the wrath of Harry? Ha!"
Yeah, probably," Luce mumbled. She wasn't totally sure whether she'd been talking about Daniel or Miles. "My parents are insisting on some big family reunion in Detroit that weekend," Callie said, "which I am boycotting. I wanted to come visit, but I figured you'd be locked up in Reformville." She paused, and Luce could picture her curled up on her bed in her dorm room at Dover. It seemed like a lifetime ago since Luce had been at school there herself. So very much had changed. "If you'll be home, though, and bringing reform schoolboy, try and stop me." "Okay, but Callie..." Luce was interrupted by a squeal. "So it's settled? Imagine, in 1 week we'll be curled up on your couch, catching up. I'll make my famous kettle corn to help us through the boring slideshows your dad will show, and your crazy poodle will be going berserk." Luce had never actually been to Callie's brownstone in Philadelphia, and Callie had never actually been to Luce's house in Georgia. They'd both only seen pictures. A visit from Callie sounded so perfect, so exactly what Luce needed right now. It also sounded utterly impossible. "I'll look up flights right now." "Callie, I'll email you, okay?" Callie hung up before Luce could even respond. This was not good. Luce flipped the phone shut. She shouldn't have felt like Callie was intruding by inviting herself to Thanksgiving. She should have felt great that her friend still wanted to see her. But all she felt was helpless, homesick,
and guilty for perpetuating this stupid cycle of lies. Was it even possible to just be normal and happy anymore? What on earth, or beyond it, would it take for Luce to be as content with her life as someone like Miles seemed to be? Her mind kept circling around Daniel, and she had her answer. The only way she could be carefree again would be to have never met Daniel, to have never known true love. Something rustled in the treetops. A frigid wind assailed her skin. She hadn't been concentrating on an announcer specifically, but she realized, just as Stephen had told her, that her wish for answers must have summoned one. No, not one. She shivered, looking up into the tangle of branches. Hundreds of stealthy, murky, foul-smelling shadows. They flowed together in the high redwood branches over her head, like someone in the clouds had tipped over a giant pot of black ink that had spread across the sky and dripped down into the canopy of the trees, bleeding one branch into another, until the forest was a solid wash of blackness. At first, it was almost impossible to tell where one shadow stopped and the next one began, which shadow was real and which an announcer. But soon they began to morph and make themselves obvious, slyly at first, as if they were moving innocently in the fading light of the day, but then more boldly. They pinched themselves free from the branches they'd been occupying, wrenching their tendrils of blackness down, down, close to Luce's head, beckoning or threatening her. She steeled herself, but couldn't catch her breath. There were too many. It was too much. She gasped for air, trying not to panic, knowing it was already too late. She ran. She started south, back toward the dorm. But the swirling black abyss in the treetops just moved with her, hissing along the lower branches of the redwoods, drawing closer. She felt the icy pinpricks of their touch on her shoulders. She yelped as they groped for her, swatting them away with her bare hands. She changed course, swung herself around in the opposite direction, toward the Nephilim Lodge to the north. She would find Miles or Shelby or even Francesca, but the announcers wouldn't let her go. Immediately they slithered ahead, swelling out in front of her, swallowing the light and blocking the path to the lodge. Their hissing drowned out the distant murmurs of the Nephilim campfire, making Luce's friends seem impossibly far away. Luce forced herself to stop and take a deep breath. She knew more about the announcers than she ever had before. She should be less afraid of them. What was her problem? Maybe she knew she was getting closer to something, some memory or information that could alter the course of her life, and her relationship with Daniel. The truth was, she wasn't just terrified of the announcers. She was terrified of what she might see within them. Or hear. Yesterday, Stephen's mention of tuning out the announcer's noise had finally clicked. She could listen in on her past lives. She could cut through the static and focus on what she wanted to know, what she needed to know. Stephen must have meant to give her this clue, must have known she would listen and take her new knowledge straight to the announcers. She turned and stepped back into the dark solitude of the trees. The whooshing sounds from the announcers quieted and settled. The darkness under the branches engulfed her in cold and the peaty smell of decomposing leaves. In the twilight, the announcers crept forward, settling into the dimness all around her, camouflaging themselves again among the natural shadows. Some of them moved swiftly and stiffly, like soldiers. Others had a nimble grace. Luce wondered whether their appearances reflected anything about the messages they contained. So much about the announcers still felt impenetrable. Tuning them in wasn't intuitive, like fiddling with an old radio dial. What she'd heard yesterday, that one voice among the riot of voices, had come to her by accident. The past might have been unfathomable to her before, but she could feel it pressing up against the dark surfaces, waiting to break into the light. She closed her eyes and cupped her hands together. There, in the darkness, her heart pounding, she willed them to come out. She called on those coldest, darkest things, asking them to deliver her past, to illuminate her and Daniel's story. She called on them to solve the mystery of who he was and why he had chosen her, even if the truth broke her heart. A rich, feminine laugh rang out in the forest, a laugh so clear and full it felt as if it were surrounding Luce, bouncing off the branches in the trees. She tried to trace its origin, but there were so many shadows gathered, Luce didn't know how to pinpoint the source. And then she felt her blood go cold. The laughter was hers. Or had once been hers, back when she was a child. Before Daniel, before Sword and Cross, before Trevor, before a life full of secrets and lies and so many unanswerable questions, before she'd ever seen an angel. It was too innocent a laugh, too carefree to belong to her anymore. A breath of wind swirled in the branches overhead, and a scattering of brown redwood needles broke off and showered to the ground. They pattered like raindrops as they joined 1,000 predecessors on the mulchy forest floor. Among them was one large frond. Thick and feathery, fully intact, it drifted slowly down somehow outside the power of gravity. It was black instead of brown, and instead of falling to the ground, it drifted lightly onto Luce's outstretched palm. Not a frond, but an announcer. As she leaned down to examine it more closely, she heard the laughter again. Somewhere inside, another Luce was laughing. Gently, Luce gave the announcer's prickly edges a pull. It was more pliant than she expected, but cold as ice and tacky against her fingers. It grew larger at the lightest touch. When it had grown to about a square foot, Luce released it from her grip and was pleased to watch it hover at eye level in front of her. She made a special effort to focus, on hearing, on tuning out the world around her. Nothing at first. And then one more rising laugh sang out from within the shadow. Then the veil of blackness shredded, and an image inside became clear. This time, Daniel was the first one to come into view. Even through the announcer's screen, it was heaven to see him. His hair was a couple of inches longer than he wore it now. And he was tan. His shoulders and the bridge of his nose were both a deep, golden brown. He wore trim navy swim trunks, snug around his hips, the kind she'd seen in family pictures from the 70s. He made them look so good. Behind Daniel was the verdant edge of a thick, dense rainforest, lush green but bright with berries and white flowers that Luce had never seen before. He stood at the lip of a short but dramatic cliff, which looked down at a sparkling pool of water. But Daniel kept glancing up, toward the sky. That laugh again. And then Luce's own voice, broken apart by giggles. "Hurry up and get down here." Luce leaned forward, closer to the window of the announcer, and saw her former self treading water in a yellow halter-top bikini. Her long hair danced around her, floating on the water's surface like a deep black halo. Daniel kept an eye on her, but was also still glancing overhead. The muscles on his chest were tensing up. Luce had a bad feeling she already knew why. The sky was filling with announcers, like a flock of enormous black crows, a cloud so thick they blocked the sun. The long-ago Luce in the water noticed nothing, saw nothing. But watching all those announcers flit and gather in the humid air of that rainforest, in an image made by an announcer, had the Luce in the forest feeling suddenly dizzy. "You make me wait forever," long-ago Luce called up to Daniel. "Pretty soon I'm going to freeze." Daniel tore his eyes away from the sky, looking down at her with a broken expression. His lip was trembling, and his face was ghostly white.
"You won't freeze," he told her.
Were those tears Daniel was wiping away? He closed his eyes and shivered. Then, arcing his hands over his head, he pushed off the rock and dove. Daniel surfaced a moment later, and long-ago Luce swam toward him. She wrapped her arms around his neck, her face bright and happy. Luce watched it all play out with a mixture of sickness and satisfaction. She wanted her former self to have as much of Daniel as she could get, to feel that innocent, ecstatic closeness of being with a person she loved. But she knew, just as Daniel knew, as the swarm of announcers knew, exactly what was going to happen as soon as this Luce pressed her lips to his. Daniel was right. She wasn't going to freeze. She was going to combust in a horrifying burst of flames, and Daniel would be left to mourn her. But he wasn't the only one. This girl had had a life, friends, and a family who loved her, who would be devastated when they lost her. Suddenly, Luce was enraged, furious with the curse that had been hanging over her and Daniel. She had been innocent, powerless. She didn't understand a thing about what was going to happen. She still didn't understand why it happened, why she always had to die so quickly after finding Daniel. Why it hadn't happened to her yet in this life. The Luce in the water was still alive. Luce wouldn't, couldn't let her die. She grabbed at the announcer, curling its edges in her fists. It twisted and bent, contorting the swimmer's images like a funhouse mirror might. Inside its screen, the other shadows were descending. The swimmers were running out of time. In frustration, Luce screamed and swung her fists at the announcer, first one, then the other, raining blows upon the scene before her. She struck out at it again and again, heaving and crying, as she tried her best to stop what was going to transpire. Then it happened. Her right fist broke through, and her arm sank in up to her elbow. Instantly, she felt the shock of a temperature change, the heat of a summer sunset spreading across her palm. Gravity shifted. Luce couldn't tell which way was up or down. She felt her stomach recoiling and feared she was going to throw up. She could go through. She could save her old self. Tentatively, she stretched her left arm forward. It, too, disappeared into the announcer, like passing through a bright, clammy sheet of jello that rippled and widened as if it could just let her through. "It wants me to," she said aloud. "I can do this. I can save her. I can save my life." She leaned back slightly and then thrust her body into the announcer. There was sunlight, so bright she had to close her eyes, and a warmth so tropical a sheen of sweat immediately broke out on her skin, and a nauseating scene of gravity tilting and upending, like at the height of a dive. In a moment she'd be falling, except something had hold of her left ankle, and her right. That something was pulling Luce very forcefully backward. "No," Luce cried out, because she could see now, could see, far below, a burst of yellow in the water. Too bright to be the halter top of her bathing suit. Was long ago Luce already burning up? Then it all vanished. Luce was yanked roughly back into the cool, dim patch of redwood trees behind the shoreline dorm. Her skin felt cold and clammy, and her balance was all screwed up, and she fell flat on her face in the dirt and redwood needles on the forest floor. She rolled over and saw two figures in front of her, but her vision was spinning so much she couldn't even tell who they were. "I thought I'd find you here." "Shelby." Luce shook her head and blinked a few times. Not just Shelby, but Miles, too. Both of them looked exhausted. Luce was exhausted. She glanced at her watch, not surprised by now to see how long she'd spent glimpsing the announcer. It was after 1 in the morning. What were Miles and Shelby still doing up?
What were you trying to...
Miles stammered, pointing at the place where the announcer had been. She looked over her shoulder. It had splintered into hundreds of shadowy pine needles that rained down, brittle enough to turn to ash where they landed.
"I think I'm going to be sick," Luce muttered, rolling to the side and aiming behind a nearby tree.
She heaved a few times, but nothing came up. She closed her eyes, racked with guilt. She'd been too weak and too late to save herself. A cool hand reached around and pulled her short blonde waves back from her face. Luce saw Shelby's frayed black yoga pants and flip-flopped feet and felt a wave of gratitude. "Thanks," she said. After a long moment, she wiped her mouth and unsteadily got to her feet. "Are you mad at me?"
"What mad? I'm proud of you. You figured it out. Why do you even need someone like me anymore?"
Shelby gave Luce a one-shoulder shrug.
"Shelby." "No, I'll tell you why you need me," Shelby blurted. "To keep you out of catastrophes like the one you almost just threw yourself into. Willy-nilly, might I add. What were you trying to do? Do you know what happens to people who go inside announcers?"
Luce shook her head.
"Me neither, but I doubt it's pretty."
"You just have to know what you're doing," Miles said suddenly from behind them. His face looked paler than normal. Luce must have really shaken him up.
"Oh, and I presume you know what you're doing?" Shelby challenged.
"No," he mumbled.
"But one summer my parents made me take a workshop with this old angel who knew how, okay?"
He turned to Luce.
"And the way you were doing it wasn't even close. You really scared me, Luce."
"I'm sorry." Luce winced. Shelby and Miles were acting like she'd betrayed them by coming out here alone. "I thought you guys were going to the campfire behind the lodge."
"We thought you were going," Shelby shot back.
We were there for a while, but then Jasmine started crying about how Dawn had disappeared, and the teachers got all weird, especially when they realized you were missing too. So the party kind of broke up. So then I mentioned casually to Miles that I kind of, sort of, have an idea what you might be up to, and that I'm off to find you, and suddenly he's Mr. Superglue.
Wait a minute, Luce broke in. Dawn disappeared?
Probably not, Miles offered. I mean, you know how she and Jasmine are. They're just flighty.
But it was her party, Luce said. She wouldn't miss her own party.
That's what Jasmine kept saying, Miles offered. She didn't come to the room last night and wasn't at mess this morning, so finally Frankie and Steven instructed us all to go back to the dorms, but...
$20 says Dawn's mugging down with some non-neff greaseball in the woods around here.
Shelby rolled her eyes.
No. Luce had a bad feeling about this. Dawn had been so excited about the campfire. She'd ordered T-shirts online, even though there was no way in the world she'd be able to convince any of the Nephilim kids to wear them. She wouldn't just disappear, not of her own volition. How long has she been gone?
When the three of them came out of the woods, Luce was even more shaken up. And not just about Dawn. She was shaken by what she'd seen in the announcer. Watching death close in on her former self was agony, and this was the first time she had seen it. Daniel, on the other hand, had had to watch it hundreds of times. Only now could she understand why he'd been so cold to her when they first met, to save them both the trauma of going through another gruesome death. The reality of Daniel's plight began to overwhelm her, and she was desperate to see him. Crossing the lawn to the dorm, Luce had to shade her eyes. Powerful flashlights were sweeping over the campus. A helicopter droned in the distance, its searchlight tracing the shoreline, sweeping back and forth along the beach. A wide line of men in dark uniforms walked along the path from the Nephilim Lodge to the mess hall, slowly scanning the ground. Miles said,
"That's standard formation for search parties. Form a line and leave no inch of ground uncovered."
"Oh, God," Luce said under her breath.
"She really is missing," Shelby winced.
"Not good karma."
Luce broke into a jog toward the Nephilim Lodge. Miles and Shelby followed. The path, decked with flowers and so pretty in the daylight, now looked overgrown with shadow. Ahead of them, the campfire in the pit had faded to glowing embers, but all the lights were on at the lodge, inside each of the two stories, and all around the deck. The great A-frame building was ablaze and looked formidable in the dark night. Luce could see the scared faces of a lot of the Nephilim kids who were sitting on the benches around the deck. Jasmine was crying, her red-knit cap tugged low on her head. She was holding Lilith's stiff hand for support as two cops with notebooks ran through a bunch of questions. Luce's heart went out to the girl. She knew how horrific that process could be. The cops swarmed around the deck, passing out blown-up black-and-white photocopies of a recent photograph of Dawn that someone had printed off the Internet. Glancing down at the low-resolution image, Luce was surprised to see how much Dawn did resemble her, at least before she dyed her hair. She remembered talking the morning after she'd done it, how Dawn kept joking about there not being Twinkies anymore. Luce covered her gasp with her hand. Her head hurt as she began to add up so many things that hadn't made sense. Until now. The awful moment on the life raft, Stephen's harsh warning about keeping it a secret, Daniel's paranoia about dangers he'd never explained to Luce, the outcast who'd lured her off campus, the threat that Cam had destroyed in the forest, the way Dawn looked so much like her in the fuzzy black-and-white photograph. Whoever took Dawn had been mistaken. It was Luce they wanted.
12. 7 days. Friday morning, Luce's eyes blinked open and fell on the clock. 7:30 a.m. She'd barely gotten any sleep. She was a mess, worried sick about Dawn and still angry about the past life she'd witnessed the day before via the announcer. It was so eerie to have seen the moments leading up to her death. Would they all have been like that? Her mind kept running up against the same roadblock over and over again. If it hadn't been for Daniel, would she have had a shot at a normal life, a relationship with someone else, getting married, having kids, and growing old like the rest of the world? If it hadn't been for Daniel falling in love with her ages ago, would Dawn be missing right now?
These questions were all detours, which eventually flowed back to the most important one. Would love be different with someone else? Was love even possible with someone else? Love was supposed to be easy, wasn't it? Then why did she feel so tormented? Shelby's head swung down from the top bunk, her thick blonde ponytail dropping behind her like a heavy rope.
Are you as freaked out by all this as I am?
Luce patted the bed for Shelby to scoot down and sit next to her. Still in her thick red flannel pajamas, Shelby slid onto Luce's bed, bringing two giant bars of dark chocolate with her. Luce was going to say she couldn't possibly eat, but as the scent of the chocolate wafted to her nose, she peeled back the bronze foil and gave Shelby a tiny smile.
"Hits the spot," Shelby said. "You know that thing I said last night about Don making out with some greaseball? I feel really bad about it."
Luce shook her head.
"Oh, Shell, you didn't know. You can't feel bad about that."
She, on the other hand, had plenty of reason to feel sick over what had happened to Don. Luce had spent so much time already feeling responsible for the deaths of people near her. Trevor, then Todd, then poor, poor Penn. Her throat closed up at the thought of adding Don to the list. She wiped a silent tear away before Shelby could see. It was getting to a point where she was going to have to quarantine herself to stay away from everyone she loved so that they could be safe. A knock on their door made Luce and Shelby both jump. The door opened slowly. Miles.
They found Dawn.
What?
Luce and Shelby asked, sitting up in unison. Miles dragged Luce's desk chair over to the bed and sat facing the girls. He took his cap off and wiped his forehead. It was beaded with sweat, like he'd come running across campus to tell them.
I couldn't sleep last night, he said, turning the cap in his hands. I was up early, walking around. I ran into Stephen, and he told me the good news. The people who took her brought her back around sunrise. She's shaken up, but she's not hurt.
That's a miracle, Shelby murmured.
Luce was more dubious.
I don't get it. They just brought her back, unharmed? When does that ever happen?
And how long had it taken whoever they were to realize they had the wrong girl?
It wasn't that simple, Miles admitted. Stephen was involved. He rescued her.
From who? Luce practically shouted.
Miles shrugged, rocking back on two legs of the chair.
Beats me. I'm sure Stephen knows, but I'm not exactly his first choice for pillow talk.
The idea made Shelby hoot. That Dawn had been found, unharmed, seemed to relax everyone except Luce. Her body was growing numb. She couldn't stop thinking, it should have been me. She got out of bed and grabbed a t-shirt and jeans from her closet. She had to find Dawn. Dawn was the only person who could answer her questions. And even though Dawn would never understand, Luce knew she owed her an apology.
Stephen did say that the people who took her won't be back anymore, Miles added, watching Luce worriedly.
And you believe him? Luce scoffed.
Why shouldn't he? A voice asked from the open doorway. Francesca was leaning up against the threshold in a khaki trench coat. She was radiating calm, but she didn't seem exactly happy to see them.
Dawn is home now, and she's safe.
I want to see her, Luce said, feeling ridiculous standing there in the tattered t-shirt and running shorts she'd slept in. Francesca pursed her lips. Dawn's family picked her up an hour ago. She'll be back at Shoreline when the time is right.
Why are you acting like nothing happened?
Luce threw up her arms.
Like Dawn wasn't kidnapped.
She wasn't kidnapped, Francesca corrected.
She was borrowed, and it turned out to be a mistake. Stephen handled it.
Is that supposed to make us feel better? She was borrowed. For what? Luce searched Francesca's features and saw nothing but level-headed calm. But then something in Francesca's blue eyes changed. They narrowed, then widened, and a silent plea passed from Francesca to Luce. Francesca wanted Luce not to show what she suspected in front of Miles or Shelby. Luce didn't know why, but she trusted Francesca.
Stephen and I expect that the rest of you will be quite shaken up, Francesca continued, widening her gaze to include Miles and Shelby. Classes are canceled today, and we'll be in our offices if you'd like to come by and talk.
She smiled in that dazzling, angelic way of hers, then turned on her high heels and clicked down the hallway. Shelby got up and shut the door behind Francesca.
Can you believe she used the term borrowed to refer to a human being? Is Don a library book?
She balled her hands up.
We have to do something to take our minds off this. I mean, I'm glad Don's safe, and I trust Stephen, I think, but I'm still thoroughly creeped out.
You're right, said Luce, looking over at Miles. We'll distract ourselves. We could go for a walk.
Too dangerous.
Shelby's eyes darted from side to side.
Or watch a movie. Too inactive. My mind will drift.
Eddie said something about a soccer game during lunch, Miles threw out.
Shelby clamped a hand over her forehead.
Need I remind you I am done with Shoreline Boys?
How about a board game? Finally, Shelby's eyes lit up.
How about the game of life, as in your past lives? We could do that thing where we track down your relatives again. I could help you.
Luce chewed on her lower lip. Punching through that announcer yesterday had seriously rocked her foundation. She was still physically disoriented, emotionally exhausted, and that didn't even begin to address how it had made her feel about Daniel.
I don't know, she said.
You mean more of what you were doing yesterday? Miles asked.
Shelby cranked her head around and glared at Miles.
Are you still here?
Miles picked up a pillow that had fallen on the floor and chucked it at her. She swatted it back at him, seeming impressed with her own reflexes.
Okay, fine. Miles can stay. Mascots are always handy. And we may need someone to throw under a bus. Right, Luce?
Luce closed her eyes. Yes, she was dying to know more about her past, but what if it was as hard to swallow as it had been the day before? Even with Miles and Shelby at her side, she was scared to try again. But then she remembered the day Francesca and Stephen had glimpsed the Sodom and Gomorrah announcer in front of the class. Afterward, the other students had reeled, but Luce kept thinking that whether or not they had glimpsed that gruesome scene didn't matter in the least. It would still have happened, just like her past. For the sakes of all her former selves, Luce couldn't turn away now.
Let's do it, she said to her friends.
Miles gave the girls a few minutes to get dressed, and they reconvened in the hallway. But then Shelby refused to go out to the forest where Luce had summoned the announcers.
Don't look at me like that. Don just got nabbed, and the woods are dark and creepy. I don't really want to be next, you know?
That was when Miles insisted it would be good for Luce to try to practice summoning the announcers somewhere new, like the dorm room.
Just whistle and bring 'em running, he said. Make those announcers your bitches. You know you want to.
I don't want them to start lurking around here, though, Shelby said, turning to Luce. No offense, but a girl likes her privacy.
Luce wasn't offended. But it wasn't like the announcers ever really stopped following her, regardless of when she summoned them. She didn't want the shadows dropping by the dorm room unannounced any more than Shelby did.
The thing with the announcers is demonstrating control. It's like training a new puppy. You just have to let it know who's boss.
Luce cocked her head at Miles.
Since when do you know so much useful stuff about the announcers?
Miles blushed.
I may not always apply myself in class, but I am capable of a few things.
So what? She just stands there and summons? Shelby asked.
Luce stood on Shelby's rainbow-colored yoga mat in the center of the room and thought about how Stephen had coached her. Let's open a window, she said. Shelby hopped up to raise the sash of the broad window, letting in a fresh blast of chilling sea air.
Good idea. Makes it more hospitable.
And cold, Miles said, pulling up the hood of his sweatshirt.
Then the two of them sat on the bed facing Luce as if she were a performer on a stage. She closed her eyes, trying not to feel on the spot. But instead of thinking of the shadows, instead of summoning them in her mind, all she could think of was Dawn, and how terrified she must have been the night before, how she must be feeling even now, back with her family. She'd bounced back after the freakish incident on the yacht, but this was so much more serious. And it was Luce's fault. Well, Luce's and Daniel's for bringing her here. He kept saying he was taking her to a safer place. Now Luce wondered whether all he was really doing was making Shoreline dangerous for everyone else. A gasp from Miles made Luce open her eyes. She looked just above the window, where a large charcoal gray announcer was pressed against the ceiling. At first, it looked like it could have been a normal shadow, cast by the floor lamp Shelby moved into the corner when she did her vinyasa. But then the announcer began to spread across the ceiling, until the room looked as if it had been given a deftly coat of paint, leaving a cold, foul-smelling wake over Luce's head, out of her reach. The announcer she hadn't even summoned, the announcer that could contain, well, anything, was taunting her. She inhaled nervously, remembering what Miles had said about control. She concentrated so fiercely that her brain began to hurt. Her face was red, and her eyes were strained to the point where she was going to have to just give up. But then, the announcer buckled, sliding down to Luce's feet like a thick bolt of dropped fabric. Squinting, she discerned a smaller, plumper, brownish shadow hovering over the larger, darker one, tracing its movements, almost the way a sparrow might fly closely in line with a hawk. What was this one after?
Incredible, Miles whispered.
Luce tried to let Miles's words sink in as a compliment. These things that had terrorized her all her life, that made her miserable, that she'd always feared, now they served her, which really was kind of incredible. It hadn't occurred to her until she'd seen the intrigue on Miles's face. For the first time, she felt pretty badass. She controlled her breathing and took her time guiding it off the floor and into her hands. Once the large gray announcer was within reach, the smaller one poured to the floor like a golden bend of the light from the window, blending in with the hardwood planks. Luce took the edges of the announcer and held her breath, praying that the message inside was more innocent than yesterday's. She tugged, surprised to feel the shadow give her more resistance than any of the others had. It looked so sheer and insubstantial, but felt stiff in her hands. By the time she'd coaxed it into a window about a foot square, her arms were aching. "This is the best I can do," she told Miles and Shelby. They stood up, drawing close. The gray veil within the announcer lifted, or Luce thought it did, but then another gray veil lay underneath. She squinted until she saw the gray texture roiling and moving, realizing it wasn't the shadow she was seeing anymore. The gray veil they were looking at was a thick cloud of cigarette smoke. Shelby coughed. The smoke never really cleared, but Luce's eyes got used to it. Soon she could see a broad half-moon table with a red felt top. Playing cards were arrayed in neat rows across its surface. A row of strangers sat crowded at one side. Some looked jumpy and nervous, like the bald man who kept loosening his polka-dot tie and whistling under his breath. Others looked exhausted, like the hairsprayed woman ashing a cigarette into a half-full glass of something. Her gloopy mascara was wearing off her upper lashes, leaving a seam of black grit under her eyes. And across the table, a pair of hands were flying through a deck of cards, expertly flipping over a card at a time to each person at the table. Luce inched closer to Miles so she could get a better look. She was distracted by the flashing neon lights from 1,000 slot machines just beyond. She was distracted by the flashing neon lights from 1,000 slot machines just beyond the tables. That was before she saw the dealer. She thought she'd get used to seeing versions of herself in the announcers. Young, hopeful, ever naive. But this was different. The woman dealing cards in the seedy casino wore a white Oxford shirt, snug black pants, and a black vest that bulged at the chest. Her fingernails were long and red, with sequins sparkling on both pinkies, and she kept using them to flick her black hair out of her face. Her focus hovered just above the hairlines of the players, so she never really looked anyone in the eye. She was three times as old as Luce, but there was still something between them.
"Is that you?" Miles whispered, trying hard not to sound horrified.
"No," Shelby said flatly. "That broad is old, and Luce only lives to be 17. She shot Luce a nervous look. "I mean, in the past, that's been the deal. This time, though, I'm sure she'll live to a ripe old age. Maybe as old as this lady. I mean..."
"Enough, Shelby," Luce said.
Miles shook his head.
"I have so much catching up to do."
"Okay, if it's not me, we must be... I don't know, somehow related." Luce watched as the woman cashed out chips for the bald man with the tie. Her hands looked sort of like Luce's. The way her mouth set was similarly serious. "Do you think it's my mom? Or my sister?" Shelby was scribbling notes furiously on the inside back cover of a yoga manual. "Only one way to find out." She flashed her notes at Luce. "Vegas. Mirage Hotel and Casino. Night shift. Table stationed near the Bengal Tiger Show. Vera with a Lee press on nails." She looked back at the dealer. Shelby was a stickler for the details that Luce never noticed. The dealer's name tag read Vera in lopsided white letters. But the image was starting to wobble and fade. Soon, the whole image broke apart into tiny shadow shreds that fell to the floor and curled up like the ash from burning paper.
But wait, isn't this the past? Luce asked.
Don't think so, Shelby said. Or at least it's not far in the past. There was an ad for the new Cirque du Soleil in the background. So, what do you say?
Go all the way to Las Vegas to find this woman? A middle-aged sister would probably be easier to approach than parents well into their 80s. But still, what if they made it all the way to Vegas and Luce choked again? Shelby nudged her.
Hey, I must really like you if I'm agreeing to go to Vegas. My mom was a waitress there for a couple of years when I was a kid. I'm telling you, it's hell on earth.
How would we get there? Luce asked, not wanting to ask Shelby if they could borrow SAEB's car again. How far is Vegas anyway?
Too far to drive, Miles spoke up. Which is fine with me, because I've been wanting to practice stepping through.
Stepping through? Luce asked.
Stepping through.
Miles knelt down on the ground and brushed the fragments of the shadow together in his palms. They looked almost tired, but Miles kept kneading them with his fingers until they formed a loose, messy ball.
I told you I couldn't sleep last night. I sort of broke into Stephen's office through the transom.
Yeah, right, Shelby balked. You flunked levitation. You're definitely not good enough to float in through the transom.
And you're not strong enough to drag the bookcase over, Miles said. But I am, and I have this to show for myself.
He grinned, holding up a thick black tome titled, An Announcer How-To, Summon, Glimpse, and Travel in 10,000 Easy Steps.
I also have an enormous bruise on my shin from a poorly planned exit through the transom, but anyway.
He turned to Luce, who was having a hard time not ripping the book from his hands.
I was thinking, with your obvious talent for glimpsing, and my superior knowledge.
Shelby snorted.
What'd you read, 0.3% of the book?
A very useful 0.3%, Miles said.
I think we might be able to do this, and not end up lost forever.
Shelby cocked her head suspiciously, but didn't say anything else. Miles kept kneading the announcer in his palm, then began stretching it out. After a minute or two, it had grown into a sheet of gray, almost the size of a door. Its edges were wobbly, and it was almost translucent, but when he pressed it away from his body a little, it seemed to take firmer shape, like a plaster cast after being set to dry. Miles reached for the left side of the dark rectangle, feeling around its surface, searching for something.
That's weird, he muttered, trolling the announcer with his fingers. The book says if you make the announcer area large enough, the surface tension reduces by a ratio that allows for penetration.
He sighed.
There's supposed to be a...
Great book, Miles. Shelby rolled her eyes. You're a real expert now.
What are you looking for? Luce asked, stepping close behind Miles.
Suddenly, watching his hands rove, she saw it. A latch. She blinked and the image vanished, but she knew where it had been. She reached around Miles and pressed her own hand against the left side of the announcer. There. The touch of it against her fingers made her gasp. It felt like the kind of heavy metal latch with a bolt and hasp used to lock a garden gate. It was freezing and rough with invisible rust.
Now what? Shelby said.
She looked back at her two very baffled friends, shrugged, fiddled with the lock, then slowly slid the invisible bolt to the side. With its lock released, a shadow door swung up, almost knocking the three of them backward.
We did it, Shelby whispered.
They were gazing into a long, deep, red-black tunnel. It was clammy inside and smelled like mildew and watered-down cocktails made with cheap liquor. Luce and Shelby looked at each other uncertainly. Where was the blackjack table? Where was the woman they'd been looking at before? A red glow pulsed from deep within, and then Luce could hear slot machines ringing, coins clinking into pay baskets with a clatter.
Cool, Miles said, grabbing for her hand. I read about this part. It's a transitional phase. We just have to keep going.
Luce reached for Shelby's hand, gripping it tightly, as Miles stepped inside the clammy darkness and pulled the three of them through. They walked only a couple of feet forward, about far enough to reach the real door of Luce and Shelby's dorm room.
but as soon as the cloudy gray announcer door sealed shut behind them, with a deeply unnerving pfft, their shoreline room was gone. What had been a deep, glowing, velvety red in the distance suddenly became bright white. The white light shot forward, enveloping them, filling their ears with sound. All three of them had to shield their eyes. Miles pressed ahead, drawing Luce and Shelby behind him. Otherwise, Luce might have been paralyzed. Both her palms were sweating inside her friend's hands. She was listening to a single chord of music, loud and perfectly sonorous. Luce rubbed her eyes, but it was the foggy curtain of announcer that was obscuring the view. Miles reached forward and gently rubbed at it with a circular motion until it started to peel away, like old paint chips flaking off a ceiling. And from each falling flake, blasts of arid desert air shot through the murky coolness, warming Luce's skin. As the announcer fell to pieces at their feet, the view before them suddenly made sense. They were looking down at the Las Vegas Strip. Luce had only seen it in pictures, but now she had the tip of the Paris-Las Vegas Hotel's Eiffel Tower at eye level in the distance. Which meant they were very, very high. She dared to glance down. They were standing outside, on a roof somewhere, with the edge only a foot or two beyond their toes. And beyond that, the rush of Vegas traffic, the heads of a line of palm trees, an elaborately lit swimming pool, all at least 30 stories down. Shelby let go of Luce's hand and began pacing the boundaries of the brown cement roof. Three identical long rectangular wings extended from a center point. Luce spun around, taking in 360 degrees of bright neon lights, and beyond the strip, a range of far-off barren mountains, lit up eerily by the city's light pollution. "Damn, Miles," Shelby said, hopping over skylights to explore more of the roof. "That step through was amazing. I'm almost attracted to you right now. Almost." Miles dug his hands in his pockets. Thanks? "Where exactly are we?" Luce asked. The difference between her solo tumble through the announcer and this experience was like night and day. This was so much more civilized, it hadn't made anyone want to throw up. Plus, it had actually worked. At least, she thought it had. "What happened to the view we had before?" "I had to zoom out," Miles said. "I figured it would look weird if the three of us stepped out of a cloud in the middle of the casino floor." "Just a tad," Shelby said, tugging on a locked door. "Any brilliant ideas about how to get down from here?" Luce grimaced. The announcer was trembling in tatters at their feet. She couldn't imagine it had the strength to help them now. No way off this roof, and no way back to shoreline. "Never mind, I'm a genius," Shelby called from across the roof. She was hunched over one of the skylights, wrestling with a lock. With a grunt, she pried it open, then lifted a hinged pane of glass. She stuck her head through, motioning for Luce and Miles to join her. Cautiously, Luce peered down through the open skylight into a large, opulent bathroom. There were four generous-sized stalls on one side, a line of raised marble sinks facing a gilded mirror on the other. A mauve plush settee was set up in front of a vanity, and a single woman sat there, looking into the mirror. Luce could only see the top of her black bouffant hair, but her reflection showed a heavily made-up face, thick bangs, and a French manicured hand, reapplying an unnecessary coat of red lipstick. "As soon as Cleopatra's gone through that tube of lipstick, we'll just shimmy on down," Shelby whispered. Below them, Cleopatra stood up from the vanity. She smacked her lips together and wiped a stray red stain off her teeth. Then she marched toward the door. "Let me get this straight," Miles said. "You want me to shimmy into a women's bathroom?" Luce took one more look around the desolate roof. There was really only one way in. "If anyone sees you, just pretend you went in the wrong door." "Or that you two were making out in one of the stalls," Shelby added. "What? It's Vegas." "Let's just go." Miles was blushing as he lowered himself feet first through the window. He extended his arm slowly until his feet hovered just over the high marble top of the vanity. "Help Luce down," Shelby called. Miles moved to lock the bathroom door, then raised his arms to catch Luce. She tried to mimic his smooth technique, but her arms were wobbly as she lowered herself through the skylight. She couldn't see much below her, but felt Miles' strong grip around her waist sooner than she'd expected. "You can let go," he said,
and when she did, he lowered her gracefully to the floor. His fingers spread out around her ribcage, just a thin black T-shirt away from her skin. His arms were still around her when her feet touched the tile. She was about to thank him, but when she looked up into his eyes, she got tongue-tied. She backed out of his grasp too quickly, mumbling apologetically for tripping over his feet. Both of them leaned up against the vanity, nervously avoiding eye contact by staring at the wall. That should not have happened. Miles was just her friend.
"Hello, anyone going to help me?"
Shelby's ribbed stockinged feet were dangling from the skylight, kicking impatiently. Miles moved under the window and roughly grabbed her belt, easing her down by the waist. He released Shelby a lot more quickly, Luce noticed, than he had released her. Shelby bounded across the gold-tiled floor and unlocked the door.
"Come on, you two, what are you waiting for?"
On the other side of the door, glamorously made-up, black-clad waitresses bustled by, in sequined high heels, trays of cocktail shakers balanced in the crooks of their arms. Men in expensive dark suits crowded around blackjack tables, where they whooped like teenage boys each time a hand was dealt. There were no slot machines clanking and banging on an endless loop here. It was hushed and exclusive and endlessly exciting, but it wasn't anything like the scene they'd watched in the announcer. A cocktail waitress approached them.
"May I help you?"
She lowered her stainless steel tray to scrutinize them.
"Ooh, caviar," Shelby said, scooping up three blini and handing one to the others. "You guys thinking what I'm thinking?"
Luce nodded. "We were just going downstairs." When the elevator doors opened onto the bright and glaring lobby of the casino, Luce had to be pushed out by Miles. She could tell they'd finally come to the right place. The cocktail waitresses were older, tired, showing a lot less flesh. They didn't glide across the stained orange carpet. They thumped. And the patrons looked much more like the ones they'd seen crowding the table in the glimpsing. Overweight, middle class, middle age, sad, wallet-emptying automatons. All they had to do now was find Vera. Shelby maneuvered them through a cramped maze of slot machines, past clots of people at roulette tables shouting at the tiny balls that spun in the wheel, past big boxy games at which people blew on dice and threw them, and then cheered at the outcome, down a row of tables offering poker and strange games with names like Pai Gao, until they came to a cluster of blackjack tables. Most of the dealers were men. Tall, hunched-over, oily-haired men, bespectacled gray mustached men, one man wearing a surgical mask over his face. Shelby didn't slow to gape at any of them, and she was right not to. There, at the far back corner of the casino, was Vera. Her black hair was swept up in a lopsided bun. Her pale face looked thin and saggy. Luce didn't feel the same emotional outpouring she'd felt when she looked at her previous life's parents in Shasta. But then again, she still didn't know who Vera was to her, besides a tired, middle-aged woman holding a deck of cards out for a half-asleep red-headed woman to cut. Sloppily, the redhead picked up the deck in the middle, then Vera's hand started flying. Other tables in the casino were overcrowded, but the redhead and her diminutive husband were the only two people at Vera's. Still, she put on a good show for them, snapping the cards out with an easy dexterity that made the work look effortless. Luce could see an elegant side of Vera that she hadn't noticed before, a flair for the dramatic.
"So," Miles said, shifting his weight next to Luce, "are we gonna... or..."
Shelby's hands were suddenly on Lucy's shoulders, practically wedging her into one of the empty leather seats at the table. Though she was dying to stare, Luce avoided eye contact at first. She was nervous that Vera might recognize her before she even had a chance. But Vera's eyes passed over each of them with only the mildest of interest, and Luce remembered how different she looked now that she'd bleached her hair. She tugged at it nervously, not sure what to do next. Then Miles plunked down a $20 bill in front of Luce, and she remembered the game she was supposed to be playing. She slid the money across the table. Vera raised a penciled-in eyebrow.
"Got ID?"
Luce shook her head.
"Maybe we could just watch?"
Across the table, the redhead was nodding off, her head falling onto Shelby's stiff shoulder. Vera rolled her eyes at the whole scene and pushed Luce's money back, pointing at the neon billboard advertising Cirque du Soleil.
"Circus is that way, kids."
Luce sighed. They were going to have to wait until Vera got off work. and by then she'd probably be even less interested in talking to them. Feeling defeated, Luce reached out to take Miles's money back. Vera's fingers were drawing away, just as Luce's swept over the money, and their fingertips kissed. Both of them snapped up their heads. The weird shock briefly blinded Luce. She sucked in her breath. She looked deep into Vera's wide hazel eyes, and she saw everything. A two-story cabin in a snowy Canadian town. Webs of ice on the windows, wind soughing at the panes. A 10-year-old girl watching TV in the living room, rocking a baby on her lap. It was Vera, pale and pretty in acid-wash jeans and Doc Martens, a thick navy turtleneck rising to her chin, a cheap